Welcome to Sparks of History, where Jewish history and world history meet. We are very pleased to have with us today Rabbi Michael Freund. Rabbi Freund is a graduate of both Princeton University and Columbia University. A native New Yorker, Rabbi Freund made Aliyah, moved to Israel in 1995, and at the age of 28, was appointed to serve as Deputy Communications Director under then Prime Minister and now Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Rabbi Freund later went on to found and now directs Shavei Israel, a nonprofit organization that has brought more than 10,000 Jews from far-flung places around the world to Israel, including descendants of the Lost Tribes. For his work with Shavei Israel, Rabbi Freund has been awarded numerous awards, including the Moskowitz Prize for Zionism and the Jerusalem Prize. Rabbi Freund has been a syndicated columnist for the Jerusalem Post for two decades, authored two books, and received rabbinical ordination, smicha. Rabbi Freund has five grown sons, four of whom are reservists in elite IDF combat units and who fought in both Gaza and Lebanon over the last year. And most importantly, Rabbi Freund remains, for whatever reason, a loyal New York Mets fan. Rabbi Freund, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Ari. It's great to be with you.
Okay. The Lost Tribes. What do we mean when we use, it's such a mysterious term, the Lost Tribes? And when were they lost to us?
So we know from the Bible that after the death of King Solomon, the people of Israel became divided between the northern kingdom of the 10 tribes under Yeravam, Jeroboam, and the southern kingdom of Judah under Rehavam, the Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon's son. And about less than two centuries after that, the Assyrian Empire, which was the superpower of the day, invaded the land of Israel and captured the northern kingdom and cast the 10 tribes into exile. It was their imperial policy, the Assyrians, whenever they captured a new territory, they would take the local populace and remove it and replace it with a different population. And that was in order to maintain control over the vast expanses of their empire. Now, the Bible mentions briefly, both in the Book of Kings and in the Book of Chronicles, that these 10 tribes were exiled to places with names such as Halach and Chabor. And after that, seemingly, the trail goes cold. Now, just to put this in perspective, we're talking about 10 out of the 12 tribes, 75 to 80% of the entire people of Israel, in one fell swoop, simply disappeared. That was a trauma of cataclysmic proportions for our people. Nonetheless, even though they seemingly disappeared into the mists of history, there have been efforts almost immediately since they were exiled to seek them out and to restore them back to our people and to the land of Israel. And the Hebrew prophets, the Nevi'im, over and over again talk about how eventually all the tribes will come back. The 10 tribes will be reunited with Judah, the Judeans, us, the Jewish people.
And just a little bit of background, what is Shavei Israel? Why did you set it up? What are its goals?
So when I was working for Prime Minister Netanyahu back in the late 90s, one day in the spring of 1997, a small orange envelope arrived addressed to the Prime Minister from this community in northeastern India called the B'nai Menashe, the Sons of Manasseh. And it landed on my desk, and it was a very emotional appeal from the leaders of the community, stating that they were descendants of one of the 10 tribes, the tribe of Manasseh, and they longed to return to the land of their ancestors. Now, to be honest, when I first read that letter, I thought it was completely crazy. I didn't believe it. But it was so sincere and heartfelt that I chose to answer it. And it turned out that the B'nai Menashe had been writing to Israeli prime ministers since at least Golda Meir in the early 1970s, and probably since David Ben-Gurion and the founding of the modern state of Israel in 1948, and they'd never gotten a response. I met with some members of the community, and I traveled to India, and once I learned more about their history and their traditions and their customs, that's when I became convinced of the historicity of their claim. I became persuaded that, as crazy as it might sound, that they are in fact descendants of one of the lost tribes of Israel, and that they were looking to return to our people. After Netanyahu left office in 1999, I began reading up about different phenomena over the course of Jewish history, such as the Marranos of Spain and Portugal, descendants of Spanish and Portuguese Jews forcibly converted in the 15th century, who were then persecuted by the Inquisition, the Chinese Jews of Kaifeng in China, and other such far-flung communities. And then I simply got on the plane and I visited these communities and people, and I saw that they're still out there. They still have a sense of connection with our people. And I also saw that no one was doing anything to extend a hand to them and to engage with them. And I thought that that was a mistake. And so that prompted me to start Shavei Israel, which is Hebrew for those who return to Israel. And over the past 2 decades, we've grown to work in more than a dozen countries with a variety of these far-flung communities that have a historical connection with the Jewish people and who are looking to return to their roots.
What convinced you, Rabbi Freund, that initially the B'nai Menashe were one of the lost tribes? Was it archaeological information? Was it just their customs and traditions? Was there DNA testing involved?
So the range of customs and traditions and ancient prayers that they had preserved, I found to be very compelling. I'll give you a an example or two, if I may. Up until the 1950s, in many instances, the B'nai Menashe were still practicing the korbanot, the sacrificial rites, as they had been done in the temple in Jerusalem. And I witnessed reenactments of those, some of those sacrifices during my visits to India. Now, certainly there are plenty of cultures and religions which have sacrificial rites. So that on the face of it, of course, is not compelling evidence. But they had managed to preserve various elements of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, of the oral law, in their practice of the sacrifices, which they could not possibly have known otherwise. So, for example, the every village had a priest, and if his wife would die, he would no longer be able to perform the sacrificial rites. And every village had almost the equivalent of a utility infielder. They had a mimalema kom, a guy waiting in the wings in case the priest would not be able to carry out his duties. He could step in and do them. And that's straight out of the Mishnah in Tractate Yoma. That's just one example. Others, they have an ancient song called the Song of Miriam, which in effect is their Haggadah of Passover, and it describes how their ancestors fled slavery in Egypt, were guided through the desert by a pillar of fire and clouds of glory until they reached Zion. And one other mention I'll make is an ancient song of theirs called Katange Katange. That's in their language. It means give praise to God. And there are still some Hebrew words in that song that one can identify. But the main theme of that song is that their elder brother Judah, the Jewish people, would seek them out, find them, and bring them back to Jerusalem. So when you put all these pieces together, I became convinced. Now you mentioned DNA. There was a genetic study done by the Central Indian Genetics Laboratory in Calcutta a number of years ago, which found that the B'nai Menashe had certain DNA markers which indicated a Middle Eastern origin, which is not what one would expect to find in a population located in northeastern India. There were others who criticized that study on methodological grounds. I'm not a geneticist, and I certainly don't want to get in between geneticists, but I think that the bottom line is that the B'nai Menashe are who they say they are. They never forgot who they are, and they never forgot where they came from, and they never forgot where they one day wished to return, which is the land of Israel.
Are there writings regarding about the B'nai Menashe that predate the modern state of Israel that corroborates what we're finding after the establishment of the state of Israel?
The first Westerners who arrive in that remote part of northeastern India, what is now northeastern India, were British missionaries and military officers in the 19th century. And a number of them kept diaries in which they describe the practices of the members of the community. And they themselves believed, the British, that is, that these were members of a lost tribe. That's the earliest known record that we have, as it were. The B'nai Menashe come from a very strong oral tradition. It was only once the British arrived, for example, that it was the British who wrote down their language for them. Everything was passed down orally. Now, to us in modern Western societies, where we're accustomed to bureaucracy and paperwork, that might sound a little suspect. But the B'nai Menashe, like many cultures in that part of the world, people are able to rattle off their family trees going back generations in ways that perhaps you and I couldn't possibly dream of doing. Because the power or the strength of the oral tradition was such that it was truly passed on down through the generations.
And in addition to the name Menashe, you referenced a group and community in China. Who else are we talking about that are looked upon as perhaps part of the lost 10 tribes?
So let me clarify that there are communities such as the B'nai Menashe that we work with who are under the category of a lost tribe. Then there are other communities such as the Chinese Jews of Kaifeng or the Marranos or B'nai Anusim of Spain, Portugal, and South America who are not lost tribes per se. They are lost Jews. So it's important to draw that distinction. If we're talking about the tribes of Israel. Currently, we know the whereabouts of four out of the 12 tribes. First are Jews, such as you and I, who presumably are descendants of the tribe of Judah, hence the name Jew. So that's one. Then there are the Kohanim and the Leviim, the Jewish priests and Levites, who are descendants of the tribe of Levi and whose ancestors served in the Holy Temple. So that makes two, Judah and Levi. The Ethiopian Jews have a tradition that they are from the tribe of Dan. And when the chief rabbinate of Israel recognized the Ethiopian Jews as Jews, they accepted that claim of theirs. So that makes three, Judah, Levi, and Dan. And now there is Menashe, the fourth. There are other communities out there who have pretty strong claims to Israelite ancestry, such as the Pashtuns or the Pathans of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and perhaps the Lemba tribe of South Africa and southern Zimbabwe. That's under the category of lost tribes. Then, because the Jewish people, the Judeans, our ancestors who were exiled 1900 years ago by the Romans and scattered to the four corners of the earth, because we were persecuted and kicked out of just about every decent country in the world and faced massacres and expulsions and forced conversions, it should come as no surprise that we're going to find traces or remnants of Jewish communities just about everywhere on the globe. And in recent years, we are seeing an awakening among these descendants of Jews, as many of them are looking to reclaim the identity that was, in effect, torn away from their ancestors.
And what are examples of those Jews that keep certain people who keep certain traditions? They have a candle on Friday, or they don't eat pig, and they come from where? From South America, and now they're learning about the Jewish people and they're trying to figure out, am I part of this people or not? Is that what we're talking about?
Absolutely. So the main example is that of the B'nai Anusim, or whom historians refer to as Marranos. In the 14th and 15th centuries, there were a series of forced conversions of Jews on the Iberian Peninsula in Spain and Portugal. And many of those people, despite the danger they faced from the Inquisition, continued to practice Judaism in secret down through the generations. And many, in fact, many of the first Spanish and Portuguese travelers to South America who moved to settle there were Anusim, who were seeking to get as far away as possible from the Inquisition. Unfortunately, the Inquisition followed them across the ocean in its fanaticism. In an effort to stamp out any trace of what they called Judaizing practices. But into the modern era, there are people who have these customs in their families, which you mentioned, of lighting candles on a Friday night in the basement, or not eating milk and meat together, which some of them know of their Jewish ancestry. Others continue the customs, but have lost the understanding of what it means. But here too, DNA has come to play a very significant role, because more and more people taking these tests have discovered that they have Jewish forefathers, and there have been serious genetic studies carried out which have found that anywhere from 15 to 20% of Hispanics or Latinos have Jewish DNA. Again, that doesn't mean that they are Jewish in the sense of halakha, Jewish law, but it shows what the potential pool is. It shows the extent to which so many Spanish and Portuguese Jews were forced against their will to convert centuries ago.
Going back to the B'nai Menashe, what are we talking about? How many people are we talking about? How many have come, returned to Israel? How many still remain in India? And how does traditional Jewish law, well, let's call it what it is, how does the current rabbinate or rabbinical authorities view them? How do they get back to Israel? Do they come back as B'nai Menashe and go through a conversion process in Israel? How does it all work?
So I approached the chief rabbinate back in 2004. The Sephardic chief rabbi at the time was Rabbi Shlomo Amar, who's now the chief rabbi of Jerusalem. And I asked him to study the B'nai Menashe from the standpoint of Jewish law. He dispatched a team of dayanim, of religious judges, to India. I accompanied them there. We spent about 2.5 weeks there. Traveling around, meeting with people in the community, meeting with people outside the community, gathering as much information as we could. When we returned, the Dayanim presented their findings to the chief rabbi, who conducted some further inquiries. And in March of 2005, Rabbi Amar recognized the B'nai Menashe as what is called Zera Yisrael, the seed of Israel, descendants of the people of Israel. But he said, because they had been cut off from the Jewish people for 2,700 years, it was necessary for them to undergo a full conversion process to be welcomed back into the fold. So that, in effect, is what happens. And thus far, we've been blessed to bring 5,250 B'nai Menashe to Israel, all of whom have undergone a full conversion by the chief rabbinate. There are another 5,000 B'nai Menashe practicing Judaism in northeastern India who are waiting to come. And it is our goal and dream and hope and prayer that in the coming years they will be able to do so. And I think this signifies a very important moment in the redemptive process, because what we're witnessing is the beginning of the fulfillment of what the prophets, what the Nevi'im foretold when they said that Judah and Israel would come back again. Just to, one example, the prophet Zechariah in chapter 10, verse 6 says, "V'gibarti et Beit Yehuda ve'et Beit Yosef Oshia v'hoshvotim kirichamtim. I will strengthen the house of Judah and I will save the house of Joseph," Joseph representing the 10 tribes, "and I will resettle them, for I will have mercy upon them." Towards the end of the book of Ezekiel, Yechezkel, it states clearly that at the end of days, the land of Israel will be reapportioned among the 12 tribes. And obviously, to get their tribal territory back, they'll need to be present to do so. So the fact that Menashe, who are descendants of Israel, are coming back and rejoining together with us, the Jews, the Judeans, is something that should give us all a great deal of hope and inspiration.
What other groups are you in touch with? What's the next, if I could use this, the next B'nai Menashe? And how does it work? Do you get like tips and then you investigate those tips, or are you more proactive trying to, try to identify different tribes or communities in all different locations?
So we're constantly being approached by communities and individuals around the world making all sorts of assertions and claims. And it's important for me to stress that one has to be very cautious in this kind of work because it's very easy to get swept away emotionally and to start finding Jews everywhere, and then it's not serious. I'll give you an example. A number of years ago, I received a letter from a Cherokee Indian tribe in the American state of Tennessee, claiming that they were from a lost tribe of Israel. Now, parenthetically, I should mention, in the after the discovery of the New World, there were a lot of prominent Jewish and Christian theologians in the 17th and the 18th centuries who wrote that they believed that the American Indians are from the lost tribes of Israel. So that's just an interesting fact. But in this particular case, I asked them, "Well, what's your evidence?" And they told me that in every generation they have a spiritual leader whom they call a prophet, and he was smoking something that at the time was probably illegal and is probably still illegal. And while under the influence of that hallucinatory pharmacology, heard a voice telling him that they were a lost tribe. So, with all due respect, that's not very convincing evidence. I respect the right of everyone to identify as they wish, but that doesn't necessarily obligate us to confer status or recognition on that sense of identity that they assert. So we have to be very careful about it. A number of the interesting communities that we've worked with and are working with are the, as I mentioned, the Chinese Jews of Kaifeng. These are descendants of Iraqi and Persian Jews who migrated to China in the 7th or the 8th century of the Common Era. They were welcomed by the Chinese emperor. They settled in Kaifeng, which was one of the imperial capitals of the Song dynasty, and they built a Jewish community there, which at its peak in the Middle Ages numbered as many as 4 or 5,000 Jews. They had a synagogue, they had educational institutions, rabbis, everything. The one thing they didn't have was anti-Semitism. So already by the 18th, 19th century, they had begun to intermarry and assimilate. The last rabbi of Kaifeng passed away in the beginning of the 19th century. And the synagogue that had stood there for 700 years was destroyed in the middle of the 19th century by a series of floods that swept through the city. But until today, you have up to 1,000 people who look Chinese, who speak Chinese, but who are identifiable via family trees as descendants of the Chinese Jewish community. And over the years, we've been able to help about two dozen, mostly young people from that community, make Aliyah, go through a full conversion process, and we're witnessing the beginnings of a nascent Chinese Jewish community in Israel. Another community that we've been working with is it's a fascinating one. They're known as the Donmeh. These are the descendants of the followers of Shabtai Tzvi, the false Messiah, from the 17th century. Shabtai Tzvi claimed to be the Redeemer, and at the end of the day, he converted to Islam when the Sultan threatened him with death, and many of his followers joined him, but they continued to practice a sort of a mystical Sabbatean form of Judaism in secret. They only married among themselves, and there are still some of us said to be 2,000 to 3,000 of them in Istanbul who continue to believe that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah. And they live sort of in between worlds. The Muslims view them as secret Jews, and the Jews view them as Muslims. So in recent years, we've helped a number of young people from that community to return to Judaism.
And this we discussed this a little bit before. Does archaeology play a role in this? Are there any archaeological sites or evidence that hint of Jewish presence that no longer exists, or we don't have any records of?
So, in the case of the B'nai Menashe, A number of years ago, in the State Museum in the capital city of Aizawl, which is the capital of the northeastern Indian state of Mizoram, where there is a B'nai Menashe community, I was touring the museum and I noticed a series of ancient stones on which had been carved various words. And one of them, a lot of the letters resembled Hebrew words or Hebrew letters. So I took photos of it and I sent it to a variety of professors and experts at different universities. And a number of them said that this was clearly a mix of some local language together with some preserved knowledge of Hebrew letters or Hebrew words. The stones were centuries old. No one knew with certainty how old they were. That is the only archaeological evidence I have seen vis-a-vis the B'nai Menashe.
What are some of the challenges and skepticism that you face in all of these endeavors? And who challenges it? I mean, are there those that come and say, "Don't do this. It's just not, doesn't make sense. It's not worth it. It's not authentic." Or is it just skepticism from people until proven otherwise?
It's a little bit of both sometimes. There are people who say that assimilation and intermarriage among diaspora Jewry is so vast that why not invest your efforts in keeping Jews Jewish rather than finding old new Jews? It's a legitimate question. But there are, thank God, plenty of people already working in the field of Kiruv or outreach among lesser affiliated Jews. And not many people are working in the field that I'm working in. And I feel that this is where my heart is at, that this is what I'm supposed to be doing. So that's one point. Another is obviously skepticism. Particularly when we're talking about a lost tribe, because its name implies that they were lost. But that appellation is from academics. People of faith, we know that no one is ever lost in God's eyes. And we know that the Nevi'im promised that they would come back. That is one of the things that drives me or propels me to do this work. And when it comes to other communities, whether it's the Chinese Jews or the Meranos, B'nai Anusim, there the facts, the evidence is undeniable. Whether it is DNA evidence or family trees or historical records, the Inquisition, for example. Like the Nazis, were very meticulous in keeping records with names and dates and locations, etc. So, in those cases, it's much more difficult for people to challenge the veracity of the claim. And finally, look, at the end of the day, even if one does not believe that the B'nai Menashe are who they say they are, the fact is that they go through an Orthodox conversion by the Chief Rabbinate of Israel. The fact is that they all remain religiously observant after the conversion, and none of them leave Israel. So this is not about simply seeking out a better life or a higher standard of living, because if that was the case, one would assume that many of them would move onwards to other Western countries. Or many would stop being religious because it's a demanding lifestyle. But that's not the case. They are sincere in their desire to live and practice as religious Jews in the land of their ancestors.
We recently had an episode on B'nai Noach, Noachites, as a movement. Is there any connection to the work you're doing, whether it's lost tribes or those that come from Israel but have been disconnected for many years, and this and the Noahide movement? Is there any connection at all?
Not really. Look, we do not seek to impose a lifestyle on anyone, and that's something I want to stress. For example, many of the B'nai Anosim or Marranos that we work with are have no interest in organized religion and are not looking to emigrate. They have an intellectual or an emotional curiosity. What does it mean that their ancestors were once Jews? So if someone chooses to remain a religious Catholic in Madrid, but they develop a greater sense of affinity for the people of Israel and Jews by re-engaging with their own biological and historical background, that's still a win for all of us, particularly in a time when there is rising anti-Semitism, because I've seen it time and again when someone discovers or rediscovers their Jewish roots, even if it doesn't propel them on a spiritual or a geographical journey, it can have a transformative effect on them and how they relate with Israel and the Jewish people. So I see value in this work, and we try to assist each community or individual as they seek to be assisted, rather than as we might wish them to do, if that makes sense.
Certainly, certainly. Is there support within Israeli government, Israeli society, diaspora organizations for this work?
We work closely with the Israeli government and the chief rabbinate, particularly with the B'nai Menashe. Otherwise, we would not be able to bring them on Aliyah. Among diaspora Jews, it varies. Diaspora Jewry has so many problems and challenges right now, as I mentioned, in terms of retaining Jews within the fold. That it can often be a challenge to get them to understand or appreciate the importance of this work. There is still, in some cases, an element of resistance to conversion or outsiders seeking to join us, which I think is a product of our history. After centuries of being beaten down throughout the diaspora, we turned inward, and we made pushing away potential converts into almost an ideological position. But I think now that the Jewish people have returned to the world stage as a sovereign nation, I think we can afford to be a little more warm and welcoming towards those who want to rejoin us or join us, while of course upholding and maintaining fully the standards and the dictates of halakha, of Jewish law.
There have been historical figures, personalities throughout the ages that have written about or have attempted to work in finding the lost tribes. I guess Menashe ben Israel in the 17th century would be a prime example of that.
Yes.
Is any of your work based on those writings and those efforts that took place many years ago?
It's certainly inspired by it. The first known figure recorded in history to have sought out the lost tribes was the prophet Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu HaNavi. The Talmud in Masechet Megillah, in Tractate Megillah, Daf Yud Daled Amud Bet, on page 14b, states that Jeremiah, who lived about 140 years after the exile of the 10 tribes, sought them out, found some of them and restored them to the land of Israel. Subsequently, we know there are references, Josephus in his writings mentions where the 10 tribes were thought to be at his time, which was 1900 years ago. And there are debates in the Talmud about a marriage that took place in a certain locale where the sages say that because that is the location where the 10 tribes were known to live, and now we're talking the Talmudic times, which is over about 1,000 years or more after the exile, that marriage could be considered valid. So, in other words, even 1,000 years later, the location of some of them was still known in many instances. And then, as you move along history, you see a wide variety of people, ranging from not just rabbis, but also, as I mentioned earlier, Christian theologians and even Islamic travelers who encounter population groups who they believe, for one reason or another, to be descendants of Israel and wrote about it. So there is a large corpus of writings on this stretching across the centuries, and that certainly serves as a foundation for our work.
Are there any efforts to include Samaritans or Karaites in this work, or is that just recognized that that was an offshoot of traditional normative Judaism and that's just like separate from the Jewish people today?
Well, the Samaritans, of course, were those who the Assyrians brought in as part of their imperial policy to replace the people of Israel. They brought the Samaritans in. So the Samaritans, in that sense, are not really part of the people of Israel. The Karaites are people who it's the result of a sect that was established, I think, in the 8th or the 9th century in Babylonia. And most of the Karaites, who only believe in the written law and not in Talmudic or rabbinic law, most of them now live in Israel, though there are still pockets of them elsewhere. Interestingly, there was a community of them in Lithuania, in the city of Trakai. I visited there a number of years ago. Most of the Karaites there have assimilated. And in the 19th century, because of the anti-Semitism that was directed against Jews in Lithuania, the Karaites in Lithuania began to develop a whole sense of identity that was detached from the Jewish people. And they claimed that they weren't Jews, but rather they were a Turkic people who had embraced the law of Moses. Historically, that was utter nonsense, but that's what they went with. And then when the Germans, when the Nazis invaded during World War II, it's an interesting sidebar. The Germans didn't know what to do with the Karaites. So they asked a number of rabbis and the Jewish community, do you view the Karaites as Jews or not? Now, they all did. They all did believe them to be Jews. But in order to save the Karaites, they told the Germans, no, they're not. And the Karaites there were spared. So there are still small pockets of Karaites outside of Israel, but the bulk of them moved to Israel. There was a large community in Egypt as well, which made Aliyah. And in the old city of Jerusalem, there is a Karaite synagogue that still functions.
What's next, Rabbi Freund? What's your next trip to where to find whom to investigate what?
Well, look, there's we have our hands full right now as it is. Like I said, we're constantly getting these requests. There are communities popping up all over the place claiming Israelite ancestry. So we're a little hesitant to take on new additional projects, particularly right now, particularly since we want to see, first and foremost, we want to see all the rest of the B'nai Menashe brought back to Israel. Because it is such a small community, almost every family is divided and has the loved ones still in India waiting to come. So we feel a sense of urgency about that issue to sort of bring some closure there and bring them home. I also have a dream of one day creating a community of B'nai Menashe on the Golan, because historically the Golan, which in the Bible was referred to as Bashan, was the tribal patrimony of half the tribe of Manasseh. So I would love to see that closing of the historical circle there.
And that'd be wonderful. And now we have more of the Golan today, so there's more room
Yes,
for everybody.
with beautiful views too.
In conclusion, any final thoughts that you want to leave our viewers and listeners with?
Sure. Look, since the October 7th war, it's been a very difficult time for the Jewish people and for the state of Israel. And we've seen the upsurge of hatred, of just sheer inexplicable hatred directed against us around the globe. But at the same time, we should recognize that despite that, there are large numbers of people who are clamoring to come back and to join the Jewish people, who are knocking on our collective door and asking to be allowed back in. And that should be a source of encouragement and comfort to us. It should also remind us all of how precious our heritage is, something that many of us sort of take for granted. When I see the efforts that people make in far-flung places to live a religious lifestyle where there is no religious infrastructure, there is no kosher pizza place, there is no Sfarim store, a store to buy Jewish books, it inspires me. And these people, when they do rejoin us, they're a blessing for Israel and for the Jewish people. They strengthen us, not just demographically, but also spiritually. And in many cases, their ancestors were torn away from us against their will. So I believe that we have a religious responsibility, a historical responsibility, a Jewish responsibility to bring back as many of their descendants as we possibly can, whether it is the hidden Jews of Poland from the Holocaust era, people whose ancestors, af whose forefathers after the Holocaust chose to hide their identity because of what they endured, whether it's the Spanish and Portuguese B'nai Anusim, or the Chinese Jews, or stretching all the way back to the 10 tribes. There are a lot of lost Jews out there, and many of them are just waiting for us to open our arms, recognize them, and bring them back. And it's in our interest, and it's essential that we do so.
Okay. Rabbi Freund, thank you so much. You should continue to go mechayil to chayil, from strength to strength in all of your endeavors. And
Amen.
we look forward to hearing in the news more about the accomplishments of Shavei Israel. Thank you so much.
God willing, thank you very much.